Hot flashes, vaginal dryness, and sleep disturbance are the three most common symptoms of menopause. Currently, there are over 20 FDA-approved products to treat hot flashes. There's roughly 10 FDA-approved products to treat vaginal dryness. There are zero FDA-approved products to treat insomnia due to menopause. Zero. I'm Dr. Lauren Stryker, gynecologist, best-selling author, and a nationally recognized menopause expert. When it comes to menopause, midlife, and what comes after, I'm betting you've not gotten a lot of information from your own doctor. If women are given good information, they'll make good choices. And I'm here to give you the inside information. Today, my guest is the inimitable Dr. James Simon. Dr. Simon is a clinical professor of OBGYN at George Washington University. He's the principal investigator on over 400 research trials and the author of over 800 scientific publications. And Dr. Simon holds the unique distinction of being the only physician to have served as president of both the Menopause Society and the International Society for the Study of Women's Sexual Health. Nicknamed the Menopause Whisperer by Washingtonian Magazine, his numerous accolades also include being selected as one of top Washington physicians. And if you're a regular listener, you know that this is not the first time Dr. Simon has been my guest. This is the fourth time, which is a record. And episode 123, Hormone Therapy After Age 60, is still at the top of my most listened to episodes. So the most challenging part of having Dr. Simon as a guest is deciding the topic. And when I booked Dr. Simon to tape today's podcast months ago, he's a very busy guy, I didn't even have a specific topic in mind. And it doesn't matter because there's no topic in menopause that Dr. Simon has not personally researched, published articles, and lectured on. I knew that no matter which topic I sprung on him, he'd be an expert. So, hi, Jim. Did I mention what we were going to be talking about today?
I'm not sure you mentioned it, but I'm very happy to be here. And thank you for that wonderful introduction. I'm not sure I'm an expert on everything, but I do see patients at least 5 days a week. And keeping up with what's going on is a critical part of my life and important to taking good care of my patients. So thank you for having me and for making me more of an expert than I actually am, but I appreciate
That's not true. And okay, so sleep, today's topic. I mean, I know that you're an expert on this because not only did you publish an amazing review article last year in the journal Menopause, but you just gave a lecture. So even though I didn't tell you what we were going to talk about, I know that it's going to be no problem for you. So this is what I want to do. I want to talk about how sleep disturbances and insomnia during menopause are generally experienced, why it's going on, why it's important to do something about it, and then really kind of focus on all of the different approaches to getting a decent night's sleep, including some new, and I mean really new, treatment approaches. So let's just start with this. How common is it for women to have new onset sleep disturbances due to hormonal changes? I mean, I'm not talking about the people who never slept very well. I'm talking about people that this was really never an issue, and then their hormones take a plunge, and so does their sleep.
I really don't know the answer, but it's nearly 100%. So when women are having their perimenopausal or menopausal symptoms, it's literally impossible, at least at first blush, to know whether they're waking up with hot flashes or night sweats, or they're waking up for some other reason, but they're clearly waking up.
Obviously, you know, I'm so glad to hear you say this, because whenever you read the literature and you read articles about this, you hear numbers like 60% of women have sleep disturbance and during perimenopause. And you and I know from our patients, I mean, who doesn't have sleep disturbance, right?
It is nearly universal. It doesn't mean that we don't have good treatments for whatever's waking people up or keeping them up, but deciding what the reasons are and what the causes of those reasons are, that requires a little detective work. And in this very busy environment where some practitioners are seeing 20 or 30 patients a day, it's extremely difficult without actually talking to your patient and listening to her and listening through what she says, not only what she says, but the circumstances of what she says, I think is going by the wayside and complicating this issue further.
Yeah. And it's also, I think, why people very often are treated inappropriately, because they're either given the same treatments that they might give to a man who comes in with a sleep disturbance, or assume that it is hot flashes. And we'll talk about this word. Certainly that can be it, but it's not the only reason at all. You know, I think it's important to mention, can you use the terms insomnia and sleep disturbance interchangeably, or is there a difference?
So insomnia really has a specific definition. It can be both difficulty falling asleep, but it also can be difficulty staying asleep. And most practitioners refer to insomnia using only the former definition, difficulty falling asleep, but it's clearly difficulty staying asleep as well. And I really think that if patients just describe what the problem is, it's less important to put a name on it than it is to understand what it is and why it is.
All right, so when it comes to the kinds of sleep problems that menopausal women have, is it typically falling asleep, staying asleep, both? Kind of describe if there is such a thing as a typical experience.
I prefer not to answer that question.
Okay.
Not because there aren't answers to the question, but because everyone is an individual, and throwing the book at someone because the book says treat X, Y, Z in this particular way results in just what you've said, Lauren, that patients get the wrong treatment at the wrong time for the wrong underlying issue, and then we end up with this mess. I would prefer to talk about the symptoms, try and tease them out. We can do a lot of that right here on your podcast, and then help patients understand what the choices of treatment are and what might be underlying those issues.
No, that sounds like a good plan. And I do want to primarily focus on what the options are and what people can do dependent on the cause. But I think we need to do just a little bit of groundwork first, because when you think in terms of why someone has sleep problems, I mean, sleep is controlled in the brain, right? It's our brain that, and other than the snore in the bed next door to you and, you know, all that kind of stuff. But let's just talk
that's
about
it. That's a big deal.
It is. I'm not minimizing that. I'm just saying that for the purposes of this discussion, let's just talk a little bit about neurobiology. You know, how does our brain get us to sleep? How does it keep us asleep? What's the deal with circadian rhythm? You know, I mean, we hear these words tossed around all the time, but I don't think most people really know what it all means.
Yeah. So sleep is a balance between neurotransmitters in the brain that keep us awake, and we need to suppress those, and neurotransmitters in the brain that help us fall asleep, and we need to encourage or maintain those. And they're not the same. They are not the same. And we now have medications that can do one or the other, and sometimes they're needed to be used together to help people fall asleep and stay asleep. I said medications, but there's also a whole branch of psychology that's focused on sleep. It requires special training. It's cognitive behavioral therapy, sleep, basically. And those people are trained to help us who have our sleep problems relax, get to sleep, and stay asleep without drugs. And so I don't want to discount that very important potential use of psychology in this problem.
Yeah, no, absolutely. But and we're going to get to more of that, because that's so important. But what I'm trying to get to right now is, you know, we know that there's estrogen receptors throughout the brain, and we know that there's particular areas of the brain, as you said, that are either going to put us to sleep or keep us asleep. And we know that there is this intersection, if you will, between the sleep centers and things that are controlled by estrogen, you know, such as, you know, hot flashes and all that. They're all kind of in the same neighborhood, right?
They are all in the same neighborhood.
And as we talk about some of the other treatments, especially the newer treatments, I think it's important to mention this because while hot flashes and insomnia don't always go hand in hand, very often they do. And there's a big difference between the hot flash waking you up because you're hot versus the same area of the brain is malfunctioning, right?
Yeah, so I think this is fits right into my comment about the practitioner needs to talk to the patient.
Mm-hmm.
So for example, a woman who's waking up in the middle of the night in a pool of sweat and says she's having hot flashes during the day, she's probably waking up with a hot flash at nighttime with sweating. But there are many women who have either treatment for their hot flashes that's inadequate.
Well, there's that, yeah.
Or they're still having triggers in their brain, this is where you're going, that are hot flash-like, and they can be measured, by the way, mm-hmm. that are waking them up, but they don't feel hot and they don't sweat. But right. these are triggering their awakenings, and they're basically hot flashes, and they can be treated like hot flashes, even though they're neither hot nor flashing nor sweating.
Right.
But the point here fits right in with your concept that in the brain, these are all very closely aligned and connected. And we just need to tease out what it is.
Yeah.
There are also intersections in these psychological realm, anxiety, depression, etc. Likewise, some of them in the same part of the brain that make it more difficult to stay asleep and to fall asleep. And they may be mixed up with menopause because all the neurotransmitters basically in the brain take a big hit when estrogen goes down. Right. Either a hit in their formation or their secretion or their metabolism in the brain. And so estrogen starts that whole negative process, even though it might not be specifically estrogen or specifically hot flashes in the general way we understand
it. Yeah. Okay, so if we've established that estrogen is one of the things, not the only thing, but one of the things that helps our brain work better to sleep, and just I'm going to throw this term out because it's going to come up later when we talk about treatment, something, the candy neurons are the specific area in the brain that are estrogen sensitive and control hot flashes, but also control some of these sleep issues. So I'm just going to...
And reproduction, which is why hormones are so... much involved.
We don't care about reproduction, Jim. This is, you know, this is menopause here. We're done with reproduction, but thank you for that anyway. All right. So, but estrogen, of course, is not the only thing. And so when we look at other hormones, there's also FSH, there's progesterone, then we've got the melatonin story. So let's just right now, FSH, you want to comment about FSH and if that has anything to do with sleep and where that fits into this whole perimenopause thing?
So FSH goes up when estrogen goes down. It goes up very dramatically at the time of menopause and then dwindles down itself. It can be a good marker of estrogen deficiency or increased activity in the candy neuron system. And so I think most practitioners know how to measure estrogen and FSH. And if a patient is not having hot flashes, not having night sweats, may not know if she has typical vaginal dryness, but her FSH is elevated and her estradiol is low, it should trigger the thinking in that practitioner that, maybe we should talk about sleep, talk about anxiety, talk about depression, talk about all these things, because as you mentioned, they're all in the same place in the brain.
Yeah.
And this is an easy window into that discussion.
And I think it's also really important for those women who don't have a menstrual cycle to go by, whether they've had a hysterectomy or maybe an IUD or an endometrial ablation, suddenly they can't sleep. And is it because their mother-in-law came to visit or because their FSH is up and their estradiol is down, right?
Correct. It's a trigger. It's a signal. It's something to alert themselves to, here's a hormone. It's not quite right. I'm not menstruating anymore, but let's see what else is going along with it.
Yeah.
Even if they don't have the classic symptoms.
And then there's progesterone. And we're going to talk later about people who take progesterone to help them sleep. So I don't want to go there yet. But what I want to know right now from you is, what is the role of progesterone in terms of sleep? If you have someone, for example, who's perimenopausal and they're still making estrogen, but they're not ovulating, they're not producing progesterone, is that going to impact their ability to sleep?
It may. Progesterone activates a part of the neurologic system called the GABAergic system, particularly GABA-A, with progesterone and its active metabolites, whether those metabolites are in the bloodstream or in the brain. And the GABAergic system is associated with a reduction in anxiety and an improvement in sleep quality, as well as resistance to awakening. So as we go back to the snoring husband or the dog that jumps on the bed in the middle of the night, if there's adequate activity in the GABA-A receptor system, many women can maintain their sleep in spite of those things. And when they don't menstruate or ovulate, they don't have as much progesterone or its metabolite in their system, and they may become sensitive or more sensitive to those causes of awakening.
What do we need to know about melatonin?
I don't consider myself to be an expert on melatonin, but it's part of the system that can help us reduce the signals in the stay awake system. And that's about all I would say about it.
All I know is we make melatonin. Melatonin is good. If you don't have as much melatonin, it's bad. That's the extent of my...
And I would say there's a lot of data suggesting that it's safe in both men and women to take to help them sleep. Occasionally, and there are well-done reports showing an increase in headache with too much melatonin, but I haven't seen very much of that in practice.
All right. So before we get to the whole long list of possible treatments that we're going to talk about, let's just at least kind of list those things that disrupt sleep that are not necessarily because of low estrogen or are an indirect consequence of low estrogen. So I'll start.
Okay.
Musculoskeletal pain. We know that people get increased joint pain as they go through menopause as a consequence of low estrogen or just aging, and they are awake because of pain. So now your turn. You want to list some stuff?
Yeah, so I want to emphasize that that's a very important subject that's often neglected. Your listeners may know that joint stiffness and joint pain, I like liken it to the Tin Man in the Wizard of Oz after the rainstorm. The answer is this is an extremely common symptom of menopause and low estrogen. But most docs and practitioners don't even know that. So the fact that those same women have stiffness, joint pain that might be disturbing their sleep when they turn over or they move, or the snoring husband, bed partner, or the dog triggers them to move while they're sleeping, and then they have pain and they wake up, this is really important and often overlooked by both the patient and their practitioner.
Mm-hmm. You know, you and I are both old enough that we were around during the WHI, and a lot of women, of course, went off their hormone therapy. And, you know, we knew that they were going to come back complaining of hot flashes and all of that. But the thing that surprised me was how many women came in and said, I can't stand the joint pain anymore. You know, I want my estrogen back. So that was something that was, quite frankly, I had to learn about that because I was one of those doctors that really didn't appreciate that. Okay, so on our list of other things that keep people up, so we've got, we've already said, you know, the external stuff, the psychological stuff, you know, the way of the world, all of that. We've got musculoskeletal pain. What else is on your list?
So many women wake up with bladder fullness and needing to urinate, or overactive bladder symptoms, which are common with low estrogen in menopause, or with vaginal dryness and vaginal atrophy or GSM. This is another big category of reasons that women wake up. Did they wake up because they wake up and then they have to pee? Or did they have to pee waking them up? And did they have to pee because they're drinking too much water? We see women and men with big water bottles. They're drinking them until the minute they go to sleep. And 4 hours later, they got to get up because they have a full bladder or an overfull bladder. Or is their estrogen low at menopause, leading to overactive bladder symptoms where they're waking up to pee, but in fact, they don't even have a full bladder. And that's an overactive bladder to just a small amount of urine in it. And that's another whole category of reasons that women wake up that are often going untreated and underdiagnosed. Obviously, if they're just drinking a lot, they can restrict some of their fluid intake late in the afternoon and evening and avoid having a full bladder in the middle of the night and then sleep through it until the morning. If they have overactive bladder symptoms, there's a whole category, a group of products that can, medications that can reduce their overactive bladder symptoms and help them sleep through the night.
And then, of course, there's the obstructive sleep apnea issue.
So obstructive sleep apnea requires an evaluation by a real sleep specialist. In the past, these were all done in a sleep unit. We now have good devices and techniques for assessing sleep apnea in the home environment, sleeping in your own bed, in your own, with your own bed partner, with your own pillow and surroundings. But this is a fairly common problem that occurs for two major reasons. One is obstructive sleep apnea that you mentioned. Obstructive sleep apnea usually occurs more commonly in men than in women. It happens in women when they have certain anatomic changes, which may get worse in menopause, like weight gain, truncal obesity, a thick neck, etc., and or some hormone treatments, including testosterone treatment, which can in fact worsen obstructive sleep apnea. And the other kind of apnea, central sleep apnea, which can occur with aging alone in both men and women, where for reasons that I don't know or understand, we just stop breathing at intervals until our carbon dioxide in our blood goes up, and that triggers us to bleed, to breathe. And so these two forms of sleep disturbance are really important. Both are associated with stroke and sudden death, which means they're pretty damned important, but they're less common causes of sleep disturbance in younger, early menopausal women, the typical patient that you and I would have normally seen in a menopause clinic.
No, but having said that, the numbers do go up post-menopause, and there's also some data that has looked at estrogen receptors in the epiglottis so that it actually gets a little bit stiffer, which increases the risk of obstructive sleep apnea. And I think the real take home from this is we think of the typical sleep apnea person as being an overweight snorer, and that's not necessarily the case. I think anyone who is having a new onset of sleep disturbance, like you said, should think about having a sleep study. So those are the big ones.
It's one of the advantages of having a sleep partner, because if the partner is awake when the apneic episodes are occurring, he can actually, or she can actually, make a diagnosis of that person sleeping next to them, not only choking, snorting, and snoring, but actually stopping breathing. And I've actually suggested to individuals that are sleeping alone that they get their cell phone or some other recording device and set it to record their breathing, which, by the way, they can do over the course of a whole night. You set it slow enough, and they can make a diagnosis themselves when they listen to their choking, snoring, grunting, and apneic episodes.
You know, I'm laughing because when I was a kid, my older brother accused my mother of snoring, and she, of course, denied it. And then he put a tape recorder under her bed and recorded her all night long. And little did he know that maybe that was a bigger issue than he thought. But, you know, so not only do you have to have a partner in bed with you, but you have to have a partner with insomnia, right? So that they're up and can hear all of your problems.
Or a good cell phone with a microphone.
Exactly.
And make your own diagnosis.
And clearly, when people are having problems with chronic insomnia, you know, the repercussions of that, of being miserable the next day and fatigued and non-functional and all that. But it's really a bigger issue than that. You know, when we look at the potential medical problems of persistent insomnia.
So let me paint that picture a little bit more, because you're absolutely correct. Someone doesn't sleep. And by the way, this could be men or women, but we're talking about menopausal women. They don't sleep, or they don't sleep well enough. They're fatigued the next day. They have poorer food choices. They tend to eat sweet things, carbohydrates that are rapidly metabolized to sugars. They develop insulin resistance and metabolic syndrome from those. They gain weight because they exercise less, because they're tired from not sleeping. And we have this vicious cycle, because their weight gain now aggravates their mild sleep apnea, obstructive sleep apnea. Yeah. They gain weight, their mild obstructive sleep apnea becomes moderate sleep apnea. They don't sleep as well, they eat worse, they gain more weight, and around we go. And these are the kind of downstream adverse effects that you've mentioned that now require a whole team of people to help them.
You know, and to your point, a lot of times when women would come to see me in the menopause clinic, and their primary reason for their visit was that they were gaining weight and they couldn't lose the weight. And my first question was always, let's talk about your sleep. And they look at me like, no, I'm here about my weight, you know, and like, no, I'm not sleeping, but whatever, I'm here about my weight. And in fact, as you said, it's bi-directional, you know, that it goes both ways. If you are overweight, you can't sleep. And if you're not sleeping, you're going to gain weight. So, but that aside, I mean, there was that study that came out, I think it was like 2 years ago, that when you look at women who have persistent insomnia with less than 5 hours of sleep a night, that they have a dramatic, I think it was like 80% increased risk of cardiovascular disease and stroke down the road. So yes, I mean, we're looking at, like you said, diabetes, metabolic syndrome, weight gain, but also, you know, this is going to impact dementia. I mean, the list goes on and on of reasons why people need to get a good night's sleep. I mean, it may in fact be the most important thing that people can do, other than moving around, is to get some sleep. All right. So now that we've painted this lovely picture, let's talk about treatment options. And I have a whole long list of them here. And what I want to hear is both what the literature tells us, what the data shows, and then what you've observed in your practice of seeing 9 gazillion million women who have come to you with their sleep issues. So let's start with estrogen. If you give someone estrogen therapy And for the sake of discussion, I just want to talk about estrogen now, not estrogen and a progestogen, just estrogen. If someone comes in and they tell you you can't sleep, and you determine that this is something that started at the onset of perimenopause and menopause, are you going to give her estrogen? And if you do, what's going to happen?
So I will give her estrogen, particularly if she has any elements of vasomotor symptoms, hot flashes, etc., and it'll make it somewhat better. It will help with some of these other downstream effects. Remember, estrogen is an insulin sensitizing agent, might help her with her glucose metabolism, her metabolic syndrome, her waking up, her irritable bladder. A bunch of these things may, in fact, get better. But certainly, I would give her estrogen unless she had a contraindication to using it. Yes. Estrogen.
What about if she was not having any hot flashes at all? Would you still give her estrogen? That was her only symptom was sleep. She didn't have one other menopause symptom. That was it.
So I would evaluate her potential use of estrogen unrelated to her sleep for other potential benefits, including her bladder. We talked about that. Her sex life. We didn't talk about that.
She got nothing else. She's great. She just can't sleep. Are you going to give her estrogen?
I might give it to her for metabolic syndrome and for cardiovascular and bone protection. And if it helped her sleep, it's a plus.
Okay. Progesterone. Now, obviously, progesterone. If someone is taking systemic estrogen and if they have a uterus, they're going to be either taking progestogen or a progestogen alternative. But what I want to talk about is the woman who doesn't have a uterus. So normally you would not be giving that woman progestogen. If her issue is sleep and she comes to you and says, every doctor on TikTok and Instagram says that I should be taking progesterone even if I don't have a uterus to help me sleep, what does the literature say and what is Dr. Simon going to say?
Okay, so this is very controversial and I don't have a hard yes or a hard no. I think when I see these patients who come in having heard about some TikTok influencer saying everyone should be on progesterone for X, Y, or Z. And I think it's more nuanced than that. So if they want to try it for sleep, I am not averse to their trying it for sleep. But recognize that progesterone is the hormone of pregnancy, and it has some metabolic effects that favor fat storage and weight gain, which are not always what patients are thinking about when they're talking about sleep. And we've already talked about the potential vicious cycle of weight gain and obstructive sleep apnea. So I think that there are conditions that would mitigate against using it in a woman with a hysterectomy, or maybe in her, a particular patient, it's worth a try to see if it's beneficial. Also, and this is really, I would say, cutting edge or beginning to be investigated, it's not entirely clear that taking progesterone or progestogen every day is all that good for your brain or maybe for your breasts. It may be that the evolutionary effects of progesterone in a cyclic fashion are meant to be there for a woman's brain, for her breasts, maybe even for her bone. Again, these are not clear, not well developed, and again, in a particular individual, require some nuance, some thoughtfulness, not one size fits all.
And when you talk about a progesterone or progestogen, are you lumping together a micronized progesterone and a synthetic such as medroxyprogesterone acetate, commonly known as Provera, because they are different?
I completely agree that they're different. And having been the one that brought micronized progesterone to the United States at the very first, because my colleagues in France had it, and I was saying, why don't we have it?
I have this vision of you carrying progesterone in your suitcase, standing in the airport saying, I'm bringing it to the United States. Was that how it happened?
No, I actually brought it here to get it approved by the FDA. That was a different story.
Yeah.
But both micronized progesterone, which I clearly favor for many of its benefits and its natural body identical, bioidentical nature, is clearly still an anti-estrogen in the brain and an anti-estrogen in the uterus, which is the primary reason we use it. It's not entirely clear to me yet, it will be in the next decade, whether using it continuously for decades, woman goes through menopause at age 50, and we're talking about giving her lifelong estrogen and progesterone, it's not clear to me that that's the best approach or that that approach has no downside adverse effects. I think we need to explore that and investigate it more. But clearly, I would prefer for that woman to be on natural progesterone than on a synthetic.
All right, moving on. Another controversial topic. No one said this was going to be easy. Let's talk about sleeping pills. Now, obviously, there's a lot of different types of sleeping pills. But first of all, just as a general approach to insomnia, where are you on sleeping pills? You know, the things that are going to put you to sleep or keep you asleep.
Yeah. So in general, I'm against those kinds of agents. There are lots of barriers now to using them in patients. In some jurisdictions in the U.S., they're restricted. They require excess work to get them approved or reapproved because of potential habit forming or concerns about them becoming habit forming. But for some individuals, they are absolutely life-saving in that they may be one of the few things that can help them get to sleep and stay asleep. And they're certainly better than abusing alcohol or some other avenue that women use for treating their anxiety, yeah. Or men, by the way.
Yeah. And we haven't really talked about this, but the problem with alcohol is it'll put you to sleep, but then you're going to be up at 3 a.m. for sure. But okay, so this is the thing. Whenever I've asked, you know, an internist or another doctor about all these sleeping pills, or if you read about it, the thing that you always say is, well, it's not a good idea because, you know, women may end up, you know, falling or being confused or having sleepiness the next day because of these sleeping pills, and that it's not good sleep, it's not restorative sleep. You read all that kind of stuff. And I get that. But then there's the other piece of it is you have just gone through item by item why it's so important to get a good night's sleep. So if you're looking at the greater good, when we're looking at a dramatic increased risk of all of these major medical problems that can occur if you don't sleep versus the chance that you might get a little confused or maybe trip on the way to the bathroom and hopefully don't have osteoporosis and break down and break your hip. But that's, you know, but I mean, the point is are they really as bad as we always hear about them? Like, oh my God, don't take sleeping pills. That's the worst thing. You should definitely not take them. What if someone is taking a sleeping pill and they have found the right pill at the right dose and they wake up and they feel restored and they don't feel sleepy during the day? Is that really so bad?
No, I don't think so. I just think that as practitioners in the past, and I've got gray hair to prove it, it was the first line, the first approach. It was a one-size-fits-all treatment, and that's not the way that I practice now. It's more nuanced, as I've said, and I don't think it should be the first approach.
No.
But I completely agree it's not the end of the world if someone ends up on the right dose of the right medication and it's working.
Yeah. I mean, clearly, I mean, if someone's having hot flashes, you need to deal with the hot flashes. You know, that's critically
important. If they're having overactive bladder, you treat their overactive
exactly.
bladder.
Let's talk about behavioral things, because I know that that's, you brought that up early on, but I think it really does need to be emphasized again, not just cognitive behavioral therapy, which you mentioned, but sleep hygiene. We hear that phrase all the time.
It's also banishing the dog to his or her bed or from the bedroom. It's us having a serious conversation with the bed partner about a sleep divorce, not a divorce, a sleep divorce. And I'll give you one little quip that I've used multiple times because it actually happened. A much older couple where it turned out that he had very bad apnea and had trouble using a CPAP machine, and they were constantly disturbing each other's sleep. Okay. I recommended a sleep divorce, much against their desires, because they still were having a good sex life together. And I said, look, you guys have been together a long time. Your sleeping behaviors are destroying each other's lives, metabolic syndrome, et cetera, et cetera. Just get together for sex and then sleep in other rooms. And what they came up with, I'm not kidding, true story, when he was interested in sex, he put the vibrator on her pillow in her room. And when she was interested in sex, she put the Viagra on his pillow in his sleep room. They got together. They did whatever they were going to do. And they slept separately. And it was for the greater good of both of them. So couples need to find a way to manage the desire to sleep together sexually, cuddling, whatever, but actually get their good sleep in separate places if their sleep is disturbing them. And we did not talk about restless leg syndrome as a cause of disturbance in women, disturbance of their sleep. It's a real thing and it does happen. And it commonly disturbs the partner because she's kicking him or her in the middle of the night, waking them up just like snoring. And so that's on the list. There are drugs for that. There are well understood how that works. And the slight benefit in our current context about sleep divorces and sex is that the drugs for restless leg syndrome in proper dosing can increase sexual desire. And so you can get a twofer there as well, or a BOGO if you want to say.
Well, I'm going to make it a threefer because I was actually going to save this for later, but you brought it up. So orgasm. Is orgasm going to help women get to sleep or stay asleep?
So there's mixed data on this, but I would argue that in my experience, I would fall on the side of a good orgasm helps women go to sleep and stay asleep. There is a subgroup of women and men who have a variant of sleep disturbance that occurs with orgasm. You and I have talked about that. And it's very important to separate that out. But those are the minority of women and men. The majority get to sleep better, stay asleep more if they've had a good orgasm.
And I'm just going to throw this out there. I think you know I'm a senior researcher at the Kinsey Institute, and there's a paper that's just been submitted for publication specifically looking at if masturbation helps postmenopausal women get a decent night's sleep. I was not involved in the paper. I heard it presented. I will just say I don't think it was the most well-designed study, but I thought it was kind of interesting. So I'm just going to throw that out there.
And did it suggest that orgasm helps with sleep?
At orgasm and specifically masturbation. So even if he doesn't put the vibrator on her pillow and she doesn't put the Viagra, she can, you know, on her own, whether she's got a partner or not, take
sure.
care of that. Oh, one last thing. While we're on the whole sleep hygiene thing and all that, I think we need to also mention devices and the ambient blue light that comes from scrolling on your phone and your iPad and all that kind of stuff. Because there really is good science that shows that that's going to mess with your circadian rhythm and your melatonin levels, right?
Totally agree. And everyone, which means nearly everyone has some kind of a device that they use, should be setting their color scheme on their device to avoid blue light or reduce it in case they insist on being on their device later in the evening. At least they're getting less blue light. So,
and when you wake up at 3 a.m., do not play Words with Friends, because I used to do that and I stopped and it really helped. And I think that was a combination of, first of all, activating my brain. And, you know, this is not the time to do Wordle necessarily or the New York Times crossword, but also that blue light is not a good thing. And a sleep mask has really been, it's been a game changer for me. But speaking of messing with melatonin, and we know blue light messes with melatonin, what about, you mentioned before taking melatonin, and sometimes you will read that it's important to limit the amount of melatonin that one takes. And I've never really seen a good explanation why that's the case, if it's working well for you. Have you?
I don't have a good answer for that.
I've looked and I've not been satisfied with anything I've read. So I think if someone is taking a small amount of melatonin and that seems to help them, and we're talking, you know, 1, 2, 3 milligrams, not the higher doses, you know, I don't think that that's necessarily a bad thing. But I also think to enhance your own production of melatonin in the body, again, get rid of the blue light and all this disruption and everything. On the same theme of over-the-counter stuff, Advil PM. I mean, think about this. It gets rid of your aches and pains and it makes you sleepy. Yet that's another one that's on the do not take list of most physicians. So where are you on the Advil PM?
I think that generalizing is challenging for all NSAIDs, because NSAIDs can have an adverse effect in the kidney, and the kidney becomes more sensitive as we get older. But within reason, I don't see any reason that occasional use, particularly of Advil PM for sleep and for joint and muscle pain, I don't see a reason to avoid it, unless someone knows that they already have underlying kidney problems or a family history there.
Yeah. And again, you also, you hear about the, oh, you're going to get confused. You're going to wake up and trip and fall and stuff like that. And I think, you know, pick up the throw rugs and make sure there's a straight shot and have your water by the bedside if you're thirsty, but hopefully that's not going to be an issue.
You also mentioned other things in our environment, and you mentioned sleep masks, which I'm in favor of. You could also add to that list earplugs, particularly if there are challenges with noises in the house, or you have, you know, children or grandchildren that make a lot of noise in your house. Ambient sound can also help with sleep. All of these.
Temperature. You should sleep naked, because then you also have more sex, but also you will stay cool and comfortable, right?
Yeah. Everybody should know that the body's meant to cool off at night when you're sleeping, and it cannot do so if you have too many occlusive clothes, heavy blankets, or the temperature is too high. So you can save energy in the winter. You might spend a little more on air conditioning if you live in a hot, temperate climate in the summer, but keep your ambient temperature cool in your sleep chamber for the reasons we've already mentioned.
You know, a few weeks ago, I had as a guest Dawn Musalem, who I think you know because you've heard her speak on our Monday night conferences. And she's a lifestyle doctor. And we talked a little bit about sleep. And she was a big advocate of magnesium and L-threonate. And I'm just wondering if you have any thoughts about the use of magnesium or L-threonate.
So I have many patients that use magnesium for a double effect. They are more likely to suffer from constipation as they age and also have some sleep problems. I think there's data for both and the use of magnesium. I have not personally jumped on the L-threonate bandwagon, but there is a little data for that as well.
Yeah, I mean, I looked it up and there is some data, and I don't think it's harmful. So certainly it can be in the sleep toolbox, but
Yeah, the magnesium is available over the counter also.
Yeah.
And so
is the L-threonate. And I think also my attitude is this is stuff that you can do along with everything else. It's not like you pick one thing from this list. There's a whole lot of options that people have. But I think as we kind of close this out, I think the most important thing is to do that detective work, whether on your own or hopefully with a healthcare clinician who's going to help you to figure out, Why are you not sleeping? Is it the aches and pains? Is it the restless leg? Is it the sleep apnea? Is it the fact that you're stressed and you're anxious? Is it the hot flashes? Because how can you possibly come up with a decent treatment for all of this if you don't even know why it's happening in the first place? All right. So one last thing that we didn't talk about, the newest, the biggest, what's coming up on the horizon as far as pharmaceutical to help with sleep? Specifically for peri and postmenopause women. Okay.
Before we get there, I got something old and something new, not something borrowed. We've already talked about something blue. Okay.
Yeah.
So something old that is documented to reduce bedwetting in children, but also reduces urine production in adults and is FDA approved to reduce nighttime awakenings is DDAVP. DDAVP.
I don't even know what that is.
It's vasopressin in a pill. Okay. Also called desmopressin. It's FDA approved. It's available in low doses. Low doses, like in kids, can be used in older men and women to reduce urine production at night if that's what's waking you up. So it's actually approved for nocturia. We did these studies now about 30 years ago, worldwide studies that were big enough to show that we could actually reduce hip fracture by keeping older women in bed asleep and not waking up and tripping and falling, as we've mentioned before.
You know, I have a Substack post on that, specifically about how a lot of hip fractures are from women going to the bathroom in the middle of the night and they trip. And then when the paramedics come, they're too embarrassed to say they were rushing to the bathroom, so they don't necessarily put it together. But how overactive bladder at night can actually lead to a hip fracture.
So that's something old, something new. It's relatively new, although it's not new for men. And that is, there's a nice study, placebo-controlled trial, showing that in women who don't completely empty their bladders before they go to bed, that they can actually have improved bladder emptying and reduced nocturia by taking daily Cialis. Not unlike what happens to men when they have lower urinary tract infections, presumably from their prostates. And again, they can get a BOGO with perhaps better arousal under those circumstances. But maybe if they're just sleeping a lot better, there's better arousal anyway.
See, this is why I love talking to you, because I always learn something new, you know? And by the way, nocturia, for those that didn't catch it, is just peeing at night, getting up to pee at night. Okay. All right,
okay.
Keep going.
So that was my something old, something new. We got rid of the blue light. And where you were going, I think, was the potential benefit of elinzanetant, a medication that is in the process of seeking FDA approval for hot flashes, mm-hmm. which also has a target that affects those candy neurons in such a way that it should improve sleep as well. So it's not hormonal, but works in the brain in the same places where estrogen works to better help people go to sleep and stay asleep. And it's being tested in women with hot flashes and night sweats, but it might actually work in women who don't have many hot flashes or night sweats, as we discussed earlier in your program.
Yeah. And just to give a little bit more information on this, for people who are maybe familiar with a drug called fezolinetant, Veozah, it's the same type of drug. This is a cousin to fezolinetant, this elinzanetant. And we do expect it to get FDA approved. In fact, by the time this podcast airs, it may be approved. And it will have a name other than elinzanetant, which it's hard to spell and say. But it's very important because this is one of the new non-hormonal options to treat hot flashes that, as you said, is working on the KNDy neurons, the same KNDy neurons that impact our ability to go to sleep and stay asleep. So this could be a huge, huge game changer for women who are dealing with sleep issues with or without hot flashes. And I'm not even sure if the FDA approval, if they're going to try and get the sleep indication or they're only going for the hot flash indication.
So we'll see what the data looks like, what the FDA says.
Yeah, that's but I've heard it, kind of mixed things, yeah.
Yeah, but it has the potential to not only reduce hot flashes, but also to improve sleep.
Yeah.
And I want to mention in closing a drug that is not brand new, but there continue to be new versions, or in your words, cousins, of what we call the DORAs, the dual orexin receptor antagonists. These are medications that help turn off our system that keeps us awake and thereby helps us fall and stay asleep. And there are a number of products in that category. They're relatively new, but unlike the medications that you talked about before, which would be the benzodiazepines or the typical old-fashioned sleep-inducing medications, these induce sleep in a different way and can help additionally in those women who are overly stimulated, and that's why they can't fall asleep.
Again, learning something new from you all the time. Is there anything else? Are we done with this topic, or is there anything else that you really think is important to mention?
I think, Lauren, we covered it pretty well. For me, the big take-home message is one size doesn't fit all. We all must get a good night's sleep for a variety of reasons we've talked about, but the disturbance of our sleep is highly individual, and we need to look inside ourselves, to our bed partners, which are pretty close by, but also to our external environment. And that takes time and experimentation and focus.
And there you have it. This has been great. Promise me you're going to come back for a fifth appearance. You know, it occurred to me that on Saturday Night Live, the Five Times Club gets a sweatshirt. So one more time and I'll give you a What's Up Down There coffee mug, maybe something.
It's always a pleasure to be with you and to help spread the word. And you're so lovely to have me on. I really appreciate it. And hopefully we helped somebody in the audience get a better night's.
I have no doubt. And not that we put them to sleep. That would be bad. If someone's listening to this as they're trying to fall asleep and they nod off, that was not the goal, but we'll take it, right?
I agree.
All right. I will put all the information in the program notes in terms of the other episodes that Dr. Simon has done, where to find Dr. Simon if you are lucky enough to be in the Washington, D.C. area, and other information as well. So thank you so much, and I look forward to seeing you. I think the next time I see you is at the Menopause Society meeting in Florida.
I believe that's right. I'll look forward to seeing you there. And again, thanks again for having me on.